It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan pleaded not guilty yesterday to charges of obstructing a federal agency and concealing a person from immigration officers.
A group of protesters gathered outside the courthouse calling for dismissal of charges. Here's Voces de la Frontera Executive Director Christine Newman-Ortiz at that gathering.
We know this is not just about one judge. It's an intimidation tactic. It's a disgusting spectacle of authoritarianism that's directed to all judges in this country.
Dugan's lawyers have also filed a motion to dismiss the charges, arguing that the case is unconstitutional.
John Diedrich has been covering the Dugan case. He's an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
You were at Dugan's appearance in federal court this week. Talk us through very short, I understand, but a lot went on there.
Yeah, so she did appreciate the clip. She did enter a plea. That's very standard at this point. They also set out the dates for the trial. These will probably change most likely, but right now the trial date's set for the 21st of July. She's due back in court on July 9th. But as you mentioned, there's this motion, though, that's out there, and that's really going to probably be the beginning of the whole process. Is her team is pushing for consideration, arguing that this is an illegal prosecution, and pushing for that motion to be ruled on right away.
Let's talk about that motion. If this motion carried and went through, and I imagine it could probably be appealed, but if it's ultimately successful, that means no trial, right? The not guilty plea doesn't matter. The trial never happens if this motion to dismiss is ultimately successful. Do I have that right?
So if it does, you know, but like you say, an appeal is likely. So we've got several levels. We're at the magistrate level right now. Then we have a district court level that's also in Milwaukee. Ultimately, it seems likely, talking to observers and legal experts, that this will end up at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, no matter how it goes, because the side that loses, it seems at this point, is likely to appeal.
Now, a not guilty plea on top of that motion to dismiss. What are we at a stage where in either of those, the motion to dismiss or the not guilty plea, Dugan's lawyers are saying why? They're making their legal argument for either or both of those things.
Yeah, so what they're saying is that in the immunity plea or in the immunity motion, they're saying the motion to dismiss, there's immunity as a judge. So what happened just briefly is on April 18th, Judge Dugan escorted a defendant who was in court and his attorney out a door, which is not normally used by the public. The allegation by the government is this was an effort to elude justice. Their argument from the defense is that this is normal. Judges control their court. Room and what doors people go in and out of and so forth. And so they're saying that she has immunity for what she did in court that day. And also that the feds are federal prosecutors are overreaching, that they're getting into areas of what is delegated to states' rights under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. And so the backstory here really is that this is a major legal fight brewing. I mean, Judge Dugan has four law firms, representing her at some level. There's seven attorneys of record. That's Steve Biskupic, the former U.S. attorney who incidentally was appointed by a Republican, and also Paul Clement, the former U.S. Solicitor General. So she has a very high power team. It certainly does not appear as though anything other than a long fight looms ahead.
You wrote some about the tone in the courtroom during, again, this brief appearance. We might imagine a super confrontational, but that's not what you saw there.
No, sometimes I think from the outset you see the public statements, and certainly there's a lot out there. There was a lot happening in front of the courthouse yesterday with demonstrators, as you alluded to. But inside, it was very collegial. I mean, acting U.S. attorney Richard Froehling, he actually worked for Biskupic under George W. Bush, so they know each other very well. Mr. Froehling, greeted all the members of the team. It was polite and even pleasant. And the backdrop is, yes, it is super serious on a number of levels. But the demeanor in court certainly was, there were pleasantries exchanged for sure.
Talking to John Diedrich from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's covering the case of Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan facing federal charges. This is unusual John, this is not something we see all the time. The feds prosecuting a state judge. You've been looking into some, looking for some comparable cases around the country. What did you see? How rare is this?
Well, it is. And that's very well put. Rare, like maybe the second of its time in modern history. There was a case in the first Trump administration against a Massachusetts judge. The circumstances are similar. There are some differences, but they actually are pretty remarkably similar. A state judge there in Massachusetts who was charged with helping a undocumented immigrant elude federal immigration officers. Ultimately, that's Judge Shelley Joseph. Ultimately, her case played out a little bit differently. She was not arrested, as Judge Dugan was in the courthouse, but was ordered in. But ultimately, that case was dismissed after Joe Biden was elected president and a new U.S. attorney was in place. But some of the same issues that came up are coming up there. There was an immunity claim at that point. There were constitutional claims that were made. So similar. But ultimately, those were not ruled upon because the case was dismissed before they could have. But really, it's only those. Now, just to be clear, judges do get charged with things. I mean, taking bribes and, you know, assaults and all sorts of manner of things. But what this is alleging is that the judge, in the normal course of their duty, broke federal law, you know, like in their courtroom, on the record, doing what they do as judges. That is highly unusual, too, in modern U.S. history.
We heard from that protest outside there, the connection being made between this case and arguments that the Trump administration and other Republicans are intimidating judges. Now, again, in the limited time in the courtroom, do you get a sense that people are looking over their shoulder at that wider conversation, or is this really narrow, this case, the particulars, the laws involved?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question. I think the lens really matters who you are and sort of the politics in this. I spoke to a number of judges. You know, some would say, hey, like this was a particular fact set that isn't likely to happen again. And, you know, really focusing on the actions. But I think there is, depending on who the judge is and sort of where they sit, there is some second guessing, you know, of what's going on in the courtroom. And because in Milwaukee County, as well in other courtrooms, federal officials, those federal immigration officers are coming into court. What they're doing is they are matching cases of people who are in the U.S., they say illegally, and they're in the courthouse for some reason. And so that sort of sense is creating some sense of, I would say, dis-ease among some judges in that way. I would also say that there is, you know, the way this case is read really depends. I mean, I'm getting emails from people. It's almost like they're not talking about the same case. It just really is highlighting a lot of polarization. And I should also say that there's a number of readers that I'm hearing from who see some of both. They actually do see, you know, some of the nuance and some of the in-between, you know, in this case, which is fascinating and has grabbed such national attention here.
With the charges involved, if the case goes to trial, if Judge Dugan is found guilty, potentially, what are the punishments possible in charges like this?
Yeah, so there's two counts, as you alluded. One's a felony, one's a misdemeanor. Together, 6 years of exposure. Unlikely, that just at the outset, and that's only if she were convicted on both counts. But it is highly unlikely for somebody like Judge Dugan, who's a first-time nonviolent offender in federal court, to receive that sort of time. But, you know, it does happen. And there are white collar. That's what this case is called, sort of in shorthand. These kinds of cases sometimes result in time behind bars. You know, the trial judge is Judge Adelman. He used to be a Democratic state senator, as some listeners will recall. So, you know, where that's getting way down the road. But yeah, that is the exposure that she would have in this case.
And, of course, we can't predict. There are so many possible twists and turns along the way. Is there any thought that there might be a plea deal reached? Does either side appear to be floating the idea of, hey, let's just resolve this before we go through all this rigmarole?
That does not appear to be the case. Of all the uncertainty in now, just again, from the outside, and both teams are not really talking much. They're talking more through their, you know, filings and so forth. But all indications at this point seem to be a, you know, a big fight without discussion of a plea deal. The state, main justice in Washington is involved with this. The FBI director tweeted on this case, so it has very high visibility back to Washington. And then just looking at Judge Dugan's team, I mean, she has a remarkable legal team. I mean, I was talking with some folks yesterday. I cannot recall a local case that had so many, high-powered lawyers attached to it. So at this point, things could change. It could change quickly. But at this point, it certainly does not seem that a resolution such as a plea agreement are in the works.
All right, a big legal team there. Now, John, you're in Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This is your beat. Of course, you're at this trial. Are you seeing some of our colleagues in the national media showing up at key moments in this trial? Is it getting that level of national attention?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, yesterday in the courtroom, there were 30, I don't know everybody who's a reporter. I have a pretty good sense in time.
But you have reporter DAR, the radar for reporters.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. Most of the people in the gallery of about 30 people were reporters. We had a couple sketch artists in court because there's no cameras, of course. Outside, lots of media, for the indictment when we were there, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. Everybody is looking at this because of the unusual nature of it, and also it feels like an important moment. Now, the conflict that the Trump administration has with the judges works on a couple different levels. Some are like what's before the Supreme Court. That's over the rulings. And then this feels a little bit different, but it's being sort of like brought together as an overall a template. So, to your question, yes, lots of national media attention. And the court staff has not seen this sort of attention in the federal courthouse in downtown Milwaukee in a long time. So there's some sort of extraordinary things that they're trying to plan for a trial that could take a week. That's what the U.S. attorney said yesterday. And it would be highly covered if that trial does come to pass.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's John Diedrich, investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to us about the Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan's ongoing court case and watching for the next milestones in that case.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, transgender healthcare is in flux. A Wisconsin speech-language pathologist describes their work in gender-affirming voice therapy.
When people are able to make changes in their voice and communication that better aligns with their identity, they often have improved quality of life and improved overall happiness.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Barrett. 12 bills that target transgender rights are moving through the state legislature. That's according to the Trans Legislation Tracker.
These bills have the potential to impact how transgender people in Wisconsin participate in sports, use their preferred name and pronouns, and access gender-affirming medical care. And they're particularly focused on trans youth.
At the federal level, President Trump has signed executive orders affecting the lives of transgender people. One seeks to ban access to gender-affirming care for youth under the age of 19.
For a look at how these efforts are affecting people's lives, we're joined by Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay chapter of PFLAG. That's an organization supporting LGBTQ people and their families. Elise, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Can you talk broadly about how you and people in your community are reacting to bills, to executive orders, to things that are targeting transgender people right now? What does it feel like?
It's a lot of doom scrolling and seeing what's happening next. It's looking at what might be happening and just anytime you have to plan something, figuring out what's the safest way for me to go to the family reunion where my grandmother's ashes are going to be scattered. Well, that reunion and memorial is in Florida. So what do I do? Do I answer the call of nature outside for the whole week I'm down there? Do I go into the women's room where I might pass and where, after all my paperwork says I should be going? Or do I go into the men's room, and which is what the law in Florida demands, and get jumped? And above all, how many of my friends, and especially my husband, are waiting to get gender confirmation health care, and that could be stripped away any day now, you know? And so we're all very, very frightened about that.
Let's talk more about gender affirming health care, which is one of the areas that is being targeted not only at the state level, but the federal level. Mm-hmm. What are the ripple effects? What are the consequences if people can't get access to this care?
You know, the more restrictions there are, the worse healthcare outcomes are going to be, and the more trans people are going to be at physical risk, not merely because the personal health consequences of being stuck in the wrong body are serious and dangerous in and of themselves, but because the possibility of random violence from transphobic people, you know, noticing us. So obviously, everyone should feel comfortable in their own body and should be able to feel good about themselves. That's most important, and doctor after doctor has confirmed that gender dysphoria is real, and trans people who seek the ability to medically transition should be supported. But now we're seeing so many restrictions, especially on those forms of transition care that give us the best protection from random acts of violence, specifically the attempts to ban care for people below a certain age, which keeps going up. First it's 16, then it's 18, then it's 19, then it's 30. You see where they're going. They're trying to make people wait longer and longer before being able to transition, which, especially for trans women like me, means that later in life it'll be a lot harder for us to be seen as anything other than trans, which can be very dangerous. It's not something we should have to be ashamed of, but the ability to pass can mean the difference between life and death, and often does.
We've talked before about how your community around you in the area, in Washburn-Shawamigan Bay area, has been supportive of you, that
yes,
you feel, you know, you have connections in the community. But it's also a rural area, and I'm wondering, does that add an additional barrier to finding services that support transition?
I think ordinarily it would, but we've got a really good set of clinics in this region, the North Lakes Clinic, and they really have excellent support for trans patients. So I've actually had, you know, much better experiences with them than I had with the doctors who first helped me out, I guess, you know, 10 years ago. But yeah, so I will say the medical experiences I've had here have been the best of my life, but that is definitely not true for everyone in rural areas. Then you have to consider how many people in rural areas rely on Medicaid, not just for gender-affirming care, but for everything. And that has the knock-on effect of much of the health care in this region depends on Medicaid dollars. Otherwise, they wouldn't have enough paying patients to be able to stay open. So as Medicaid is threatened for one reason or another, that's a threat to us, not just those of us who use or have used Medicaid or Badger Care directly, but those of us who just use any health care, because funding health care funds us all.
How is PFLAG in this moment in helping people navigate these times and connect to resources and support systems?
Well, our biggest project right now is scholarships for LGBT and ally students going on to higher education. We know that a lot of particular programs are being cut. We know that a lot of schools are under attack. And we want to make it easier for people who have taken risks for the queer community to go on to school. We've also recently received a very generous donation specifically to fund applicants for tech colleges, which is terrifically important. And, you know, I think, you know, every town needs more LGBT mechanics. Every town needs more LGBT plumbers, you know, so We're over the moon about that and trying to get more people out there. Other than that, we're about to start the season for our LGBT fishing club, Queers on Piers.
I love it. That's amazing. You talk about traveling to Florida, crossing state lines when things could get really difficult for you and scary. Are you hopeful that there will be change in a positive way in the future, in a positive direction, so that crossing state lines isn't potentially harmful?
So I'm afraid I must say no. I don't think it will get better.
Why is that?
Because so many systems of control and oppression depend on people fearing and hating us. Mm. Whether that's enforcing the social rules that undergird sexism and male chauvinism, or just general homophobia, or any kind of a devotion to a particular way of living that someone thinks a deity has ordained, it's a lot harder to enforce any of those systems without having someone who you can spread all of these fears around, someone that you can feel good about hurting. And I can't see things getting any better for us or for many of the other people who are in danger now.
Elise, thank you for this conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the time, Kate. It's always a pleasure. And I just hope everyone can find a place where they can be safe and loved.
That is Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay chapter of PFLAG, an LGBTQ advocacy organization. Now we'll focus on one component of gender-affirming care, which is voice therapy. The American Speech-Language Hearing Association has come out in opposition to government efforts that restrict access to gender-affirming care and clinicians' ability to provide that care. We're joined now by one such clinician. Maya Braden is a clinical associate professor and speech-language pathologist at UW-Madison. Maya, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Start by explaining, what is gender-affirming vocal care? What does your work involve?
Gender-affirming vocal care is anything that helps people to achieve a voice that is congruent with their gender identity, and that might involve changing the pitch of their voice. It might involve changing the timbre or resonance or qualities of the voice. It can also involve articulation and the way that we pronounce words, the way that we change our vocal intonation up and down, even things such as gestures, word choice, the way we use language, our body language. All of those things could be incorporated into gender-affirming voice. And it really is individualized to each client that we work with. So everyone might have a different path to getting to the voice that is theirs in the end.
I'm curious about this path. Is achieving an authentic voice, is that a journey? Does this work take weeks, years?
Yeah, it's different for everyone, but it's usually not instant. There are strategies that people can adapt pretty quickly, but when you're changing anything that is almost an automatic, if you think about when you talk, when you speak, when you sing, we don't think a lot about exactly how we're doing it. And so when you make changes in that, you might be able to make the changes quickly, but most people find that it takes more time for those to become more natural, more habitual.
And think about how our voice has changed when we heard that little recording on the tape recorder of us singing a song when we are like 3-4 years old. And you think, who is that person? Is that really me? How does a voice change? And what is the impact of like hormones?
Yeah, so I don't know how scientific you want me to get on this, but our voices do change over time. You know, babies have very, very tiny short vocal folds, which means that they vibrate very fast at very high pitches. And as we grow, those vocal folds get longer and thicker, and our necks get longer. And so the vocal folds, as they get bigger and longer, our voice deepens.
And when people go through testosterone-influenced puberty, as assigned male at birth usually do, they will have more rapid changes in their pitch right around that 12 to 18 years. It can drop by about an octave. Those who are assigned female at birth don't have as much of a change, but we still do have a slight change, and our voice gets a little bit lower, and also our range expands a little bit as we get older. And then there are other age-related changes that have to do with hormones as we get to midlife and as we age that can change pitch and quality.
Considering the range of services you offer your clients, how is gender-affirming voice therapy similar or different from other types of voice therapy you do?
So we use some of the same techniques, and that's how I came into doing this. So when we're doing voice therapy, for example, for people with vocal injuries, we might do things to modify their resonance, to modify how hard their vocal folds contact when they make sound, how they're using their voices, and those kinds of things. And some of those same strategies might be used for gender-affirming voice as well.
Hmm. Do all speech-language pathologists offer these types of services?
No, there is some specialized training and experience that goes into it. So when we graduate with our master's degree, we are officially trained in everything, but at the same time, we are sort of generalists. And then as we go farther into our careers, we all do continuing education every year, and some of us might choose to do more focus in gender-affirming voice or general voice or child language or fluency, all kinds of different areas. And to do gender-affirming voice, you should have additional training beyond just the master's degree in speech-language pathology, but it is part of everyone's scope of practice.
When a person's voice doesn't align with their gender identity or how they want to be perceived to the world, what effect does that have on a person's self-worth and on their quality of life?
Yeah, I mean, it really does. If you think about how much our voice is sort of that external representation of us, anytime our voice doesn't match who we feel we are, it can be extremely distressing. There's research, not a ton looking at quality of life, but there's a paper that just came out recently specifically looking at people's goals in voice and how having that voice that matches their gender identity, that matches their internal voice is really important. And when people don't have that, they can feel internally distressed. There can also be external factors when they are misgendered on the phone or in person, or even feelings of safety. Their actual safety concerns of having a voice that maybe doesn't match you. And we also know that when people are able to make changes in their voice and communication that better aligns with their identity, they often have improved quality of life and improved overall happiness.
So what are the benefits of doing this in a clinical setting versus trying to do this on one's own?
I think there are advantages either way. So, you know, doing it on your own, it's more economical. You can do it on your own time. But a lot of people do find that they feel a little bit lost in that. There are a lot of resources out there. There are a lot of, you know, internet videos. But being able to work with somebody one-on-one to really tailor it to your goals, your voice, make sure that you're doing it in a way that is not just sounding the way you want it to, but feeling good and being healthy and sustainable and not too tiring, I think are some advantages of working one-on-one with somebody.
Can you talk a bit about pitch? One factor that you work with, you know, someone might want their voice to sound higher or lower depending on how they want to express themselves, but what can you do there and to help find, you know, to help them find that pitch?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to say that there is a wide range of pitch that can be identified as male, female, masculine, feminine. You can have two people who have almost exactly the same average pitch who are very, very clearly identifiable as masculine or feminine. So there's quite a bit of overlap. At the same time, usually one of the first things we do is measure someone's current speaking pitch, measure their range, and when we start working on pitch, which is usually not the first thing we work on, when we start working on pitch, we find a pitch that is achievable that fits within that range that is identified as their gender. Hmm. And so there are some studies that show about 145 hertz is about the lowest average that can be reliably identified as feminine. And I'm probably speaking at about 190 hertz.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah. Is there technology that measures that? Do you have some devices that you use?
Yes, we have fairly fancy devices in the clinic, but there are also free apps. So people often will just download an app onto their phone that will measure their pitch and tell them what their speaking pitch is, and then they can also look at a target and kind of match it to within that range as well.
What is demand like for gender-affirming voice therapy? You've been in this line of work a long time.
Mm-hmm. It's variable. I think there's always demand. I think people, as they find out more about the opportunities for it, there might be increased demand. Most voice clinics within the country do some gender-affirming voice. But I know also the clinic at UW has done it since at least the 1990s, and there's been demand since then.
Gender-affirming care nationwide is under the microscope.
Yeah.
Does that affect how you do your work and how you care for your clients?
I'm going to optimistically say it's not directly affecting my work right now, except in how people are feeling. I think definitely seeing a lot more worry, fear, and if anything, it makes me want to go out and do more of it. But I think people are feeling like they're in a lot of ways under attack and worried about whether those services are still going to be there.
You can hear those emotions in people's voices.
Yes, definitely.
Mm. Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Maya Braden is a clinical associate professor and speech-language pathologist at UW-Madison. We talked about gender-affirming voice therapy and the work of aligning a person's voice with their gender identity to achieve their authentic voice. And earlier, we talked with Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay PFLAG chapter, about efforts to limit access to gender-affirming healthcare.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Rhinelander elementary school installs a speech board on the playground.
It has some different symbols on it with vocabulary specific to words that our children would use on the playground to help them better communicate.
A new communication tool for recess. That's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about appreciating a particular plant in springtime.
Spring has a way of energizing the five senses. And when it comes to the sense of smell, there are a few scents that we only have a brief time to enjoy, like the lilacs. Author Chris Hardy brings us this essay on the sweet smell of spring.
When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn, with ever-returning spring. Walt Whitman. There are a few magical weeks every May where Mother Nature's perfume fills the air. She wears essence of lilac, an intoxicating and alluring fragrance. It permeates our souls, lifts old hearts, and washes away her winter cruelty. It is the smell of spring. Some springs, our lilac season is cut short when Mother Nature decides to give us a late frost, depriving us of her sweet fragrance. Such was the case last year when a hard freeze in mid-May killed most of the blossoms on our lilacs and on our apple trees. Although we're still flirting with frost, she's made up for it this year. Our lilacs and those around the countryside seem to be in spectacular bloom, or perhaps I'm just noticing it more this year. We can thank the European Balkan countries for bringing us the lilac, which comes from the Persian word meaning bluish. The common lilac is called Syringa vulgaris and has florets with four petals that grow in clusters called panicles. Lilacs are a member of the olive family, similar to other ornamentals like forsythia and privet. Anyone who has transplanted lilacs knows how incredibly hardy the plants are. They were carried along the trading routes from the Ottoman Empire into Europe by the late 1500s and then brought to North America by settlers. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson grew lilacs. New Hampshire designated the purple lilac as its official state flower in 1919 because it symbolizes the hardy character of the citizens of the Granite State. Lilac bushes can live for hundreds of years. Lilac essential oil has medicinal value, and it is used in aromatherapy to fight depression and increase relaxation. I always remember having lilacs on the farm. 20 years ago, my wife Sherry and I dug up some sucker plants from a stand on a nearby homestead farm. Those have now spread into an impressive lilac hedge in front of our house. We enjoy the flowering crab trees and the blooms on the wild plum and other fruit trees as well. The pinks, purples, reds, and whites brighten the greening landscape. But I prefer the lilac. Perhaps it's because I admire its tough nature. Ours have survived drought, 45 below zero temperatures, and everything else, and yet have endured and flourished. We need that kind of fortitude in Wisconsin. Since lilacs are not native to North America, when you see stands of lilacs in the country, someone planted them. Since they live so long, they are a great clue to locating where there was once a farmhouse or some kind of human activity nearby. Sometimes when I see a lilac hedge in the middle of nowhere, I wonder about who planted them, what lives they led, and why they left. Perhaps the long-departed return on warm spring nights to savor the sweet bouquet, if only for a moment. It only seems like a moment when the lilacs bloom. Life moves fast, and soon it will be summer. Be sure to stop and smell the lilacs.
Chris Hardy is an author who lives in Taylor, and that story on lilacs came from his book, Back Home, Country Tales Through the Seasons. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Students with disabilities can sometimes have trouble connecting with their peers and reaching their full potential in the classroom.
Some Wisconsin educators are getting creative with tools that make school more inclusive and accessible for every student's needs.
In Rhinelander, Central Elementary School has installed a speech board on its playground to help nonverbal students communicate and make friends.
Maddie Sawinski is a speech therapist at Central Elementary School who helped get the communication tool installed. Maddie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Can you first explain what this nonverbal speech board is?
Yeah, so it is a vinyl poster-like board that we have on our playground here at my elementary school. And it has some different symbols on it with vocabulary specific to words that our children would use on the playground to help them better communicate, because we do have some students who are non-speaking or don't use verbal speech yet to communicate. They have an electronic communication device usually to help them communicate their message. And sometimes it's a little bit bulky or not very easy for them to carry that around on the playground. So this communication board is another option for them to use to communicate to their peers and their teachers.
Can you give an example of a symbol that gets used on this board?
Yeah. So there's a few different like pronouns. So a student could make a message saying, "I want a drink," because it's really hot out. So I've seen that used recently, so they could communicate to the teacher, you know, "I'm hot, I want a drink," or I need to go to the bathroom. Stuff like that they communicate, or about specific equipment. So like we have real pictures of our slide, our swings, our tunnel that we have. So if they got hurt on something, they could maybe say like hurt on the swings or something like that. A lot of different messages they can use with our vocabulary that we have.
Right, because playgrounds seem like a place where communication is so key. You know, who gets to use the swings or who's next in line for another piece of equipment? And kids need to negotiate and also talk with the teacher on the playground. Is this board helping to serve those playground interactions?
Yeah, for sure. 'Cause we do have some messages or some symbols on there for turn taking. So they could say my turn or your turn. Or, you know, to communicate to one of their friends, you know, I don't want to play tag anymore. I want swings, or different messages like that. So it's really helping with some of those peer interactions that, we try and target at the younger age, the 4K age, especially, turn taking and social interactions is something that we've seen really, kind of take off and benefit from our board on the playground.
Yeah, what has the playground been like since the board was established and has its place on the playground?
Yeah, it's been really cool to see all of the students use it and interact with it. You know, this board it really benefits those students who are non-speaking and who use a communication device. But really, it's just good for all kids to have and to be exposed to. You know, there's the alphabet, there's the numbers, there's American Sign Language symbols on it. So just exposing all of our students to those things. And it's just been really cool to see them be interested in that. You know, they've seen some words, like sight words that they learn in the classroom too. They're like, hey, Miss Maddie, I see, you know, I, that's a sight word. It's been really cool to see all students use it and interact with it. They love looking at it and they're really excited to use it.
I wonder why give these tools for nonverbal communication instead of just trying to make students speak out loud? How does giving them these tools help in their growth and development?
Yeah, so some students just, you know, some students are non-speaking and they just aren't able to use verbal speech yet. Mm-hmm. And that's okay because, you know, all forms of communication are valid and accepted, you know, whether that's verbal speech or whether that's using an AAC device, a communication board, or, you know, a tablet or something like that. That's all, you know, it's a way to communicate and we shouldn't be, you know, like forcing students to talk verbally. So it's just another option for them to use. You know, so it's just been really great that they get so many different options on the playground with their device or the board, or some of them know ASL to use all those different modalities.
Maddie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me again.
That is Maddie Sawinski, a speech therapist at Central Elementary School in Rhinelander. She was with us to talk about a new speech board her school put up on the playground to help nonverbal students communicate with their peers. Now we're taking a step back and looking more broadly at the kinds of tools and interventions that help make Wisconsin classrooms more accessible for students with disabilities. Denise Clark is a special and early childhood education professor at UW-Oshkosh and a former special education teacher at the middle and elementary school level. Denise, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
How are new tools like this playground tool we heard Maddie talk about, a nonverbal communication board, how do you see these tools improving support for students' needs?
Yes, this augmentative communication device is really a fantastic option, and we want to encourage as many ways for students to communicate as possible. This kind of visual communication really assists in developing verbal communication, as well as is a wonderful tool for students who are nonverbal.
How much do accessibility tools tend to focus on the learning materials, the classroom stuff, versus the social development and the peer communication that might happen on a playground? Or do those efforts kind of cross over in, with one another?
Yeah, special education teachers, as well as related service providers, including speech language teachers and pathologists, work really hard in all of those areas. And communication is critical, absolutely, for their participation in academics, but also for facilitating relationships, certainly for safety. And the playground is an excellent example of a place that that would be the case. And so they have to work collaboratively to develop augmentative communication and skills that students need in all of those areas, both academic, social, self-advocacy.
How can teachers make these accessibility tools really inclusive as part of the school, as part of the classroom environment, and preventing them from becoming something that perhaps stigmatizes a student for their needs?
Yeah, making differences in the ways that we communicate and the ways that we learn normal and part of everyday life from early on and throughout education is exactly the best practice that we want to do. Special education is a support, as are the related services, and they don't have to be in a different place. We can have all of the students learn together. And research shows us that there are greater gains both for students with and without disabilities when students all learn together.
Denise, you mentioned earlier that schools are under stress, that there are strains. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that there are a lot of ways that the pressures that families face and that children face are reflected in our classrooms. Mm-hmm. And so our students come to school with a variety of differences and challenges, and teachers have a lot of students, large caseloads, and limited time and resources. And so we have to have teachers have the collaborative time to develop these relationships. Speech therapists, special education teachers, and general education teachers, for them to be able to deliver these services in the classrooms, they have to be able to plan and collaborate and continue to learn about new strategies. And so having ways that teachers can do those things and have the support in the classroom to have all students learn together takes a lot.
Denise, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Denise Clark is a special and early childhood education professor at UW-Oshkosh. She was with us to discuss ways to make Wisconsin classrooms more accessible to students with disabilities. And earlier, we heard from speech therapist Maddie Sawinski at Central Elementary School in Rhinelander about her school's new nonverbal communication board on the playground. Our colleagues in the newsroom are rolling out some new reporting next month on road trips in Wisconsin.
And we got the scoop because Sarah Lear is putting together an ice cream themed road trip that includes the story about the origins of the flavor Blue Moon.
That's so awesome. And Hope Kerwin visited Driftless Books and Music and is curating an independent bookstore's road trip.
And there's other trips in the works that could involve baseball, birding, and haunted Wisconsin.
So how about your curious road trip themes? What theme did you do? And what did you see along the way? Send us your itinerary and it just may pop up in the series. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
Hey, is there a dad joke themed Wisconsin road trip?
Rob, that doesn't even make sense.
Hey, don't make me stop this car. Wisconsin Today producers include Colleen Leahy, Beatrice Lawrence, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is our managing producer. Dean Knetter is executive producer.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.